Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is painter Barbara Grossman, the University of Tulsa's Ruth Mayo Distinguished Visiting Artist. Grossman's paintings depict the interplay of women in interiors, which feature intense color, complex multiple patterns, and artworks that are simultaneously deep and shallow. Her work is influenced by Matisse and some of the early 20th century French modernists, and she's exhibited her work extensively in solo group shows around the country at commercial galleries or university galleries, as well as museums and art institutions. She was a founder of the Bowery Gallery in New York, where she exhibited for 37 years. A member of the National Academy of Arts, she's won numerous awards and has been a teacher at the University of Pennsylvania, Chautauqua School of Art, and Yale School of Art. She'll be lecturing tomorrow afternoon at 4 p.m. as a part of her residency and the exhibit, which is going on as well, Visual Configurations, which opens tomorrow at the Alexander Hogue Gallery on the TU campus and will be on display through December 19th. Barbara Grossman is my guest today. Barbara Grossman, welcome to the University of Tulsa and welcome to Tulsa, and thanks very much for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
Congratulations on being the Ruth Mayo Distinguished Artist, and your show looks wonderful in the gallery. And as I was looking at the pieces, I obviously see a connection to Matisse and the Fauve somewhat. Were those big influences on you?
Yes, Matisse is an enormous influence, but not all the Fauves. Then from Matisse, I'll move back to Cézanne and forward to Bonnard and then into, you know, more contemporary, you know, artists. But I'm really a Francophile in terms of my art, you know. But Matisse has been an enormous influence, and he's led me to Indian miniatures and, you know, some of the great sculpture of our time, and he's been a core, you know, for me.
Now, in this exhibit, which spans about the last decade or so,
10 years exactly.
You know, you see this great influence of Matisse, and what a lot of the paintings are these what look to be exterior scenes that have been internalized to me, because there are women walking dogs, there are women reading books around tables. Again, these central themes that Matisse used, also in these lushly carpeted and wallpapered rooms, which make this incredible backdrop.
Well, it's complicated. They're invented, as you probably figured out. And they are internalized because they really don't. Somebody once said, oh, they look like you're living in some other era. You know, they're even wearing clothes of another era. And frankly, I'm a dead formalist. I just really, if it doesn't work formally, I don't care what they're wearing. And the rugs function for me as a spatial ploy. It helps me compress the space because I'm interested in the idea of flat and deep happening simultaneously, which is, of course, very much what Matisse and Cézanne talked about. And if I can do that with pattern, I'm very happy because I love the notion of repetition and that the repetition is no longer repetitive when you're looking at it. It's a strange phenomenon. You look at things and they shift spatially. So something that's way behind will come way forward. And that, for me, keeps the painting alive. The narrative is the viewer's prerogative, you know.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about that idea of being flat and deep at the same time.
Well, that's a modernist
notion. Sure, sure it is.
Of course.
Yeah,
okay. For me, that activates the plane, the surface. You know, they talk about the picture plane. Well, the plane is really just that millimeter of canvas you're working on. So how do you get that thing to go back and forth? Some people talk about perspective. Perspective is an invention of humans to teach people stories when they couldn't read. So it taught the people sitting in the churches in Assisi or Arezzo what's near and what's far. That's what Piero was doing, except every so often you see where things make some sort of slippage in the space. And that is the modern space. That is the 10-tone space. That is the relativity space. That is the space of our time. Compression. Mm-hmm. Fast, back, slow. And that seems to me what binds that surface, whether it's 8 by 10 inches or 6 by 5 feet, you know. And that space is the glue. Only recently I read something in my common layman science in the Science Times on Tuesdays about the notion of the Higgs boson and the stuff in between. And that's what it is.
And that's really what you're painting a lot of times,
exactly.
That stuff in between.
That's it. And that's what makes the space, and that's what makes it come alive, I would like to think.
Yeah. Now, and you mentioned the fact that these vivid rugs, like Oriental rug patterns or very patterned design wallpapers in the backdrop sort of help create that. How does that work exactly?
Well, let me just catch this word you said, backdrop. I don't think...
You don't think of it as backdrop.
Backdrop. No. I think that it's all equal. You see, the background...
That is apparent upon looking at your work.
It's not the background. It is all ground. It is simultaneous. And that's what I hope it will do. Now, I will say that when I first started making a lot of patterns, I realized that the patterns confused the issue of back and forth, which is what I wanted, and I didn't quite have a handle on it. So the pattern gave me an entree into that idea. And I think it's now become so much part of my language that I'm no longer conscious of it, which is, of course, what you hope. You know, my husband calls that when you're painting and you come back and you say, who did that? And it's working. It's called the state of grace. Doesn't happen very often, but you take it and run.
I think any artist will say that. Yeah. Whatever their media is, those moments of goosebumps and unconscious art creation.
Yeah.
Well, the things you're using as the focal point, women.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, I think in the last few years, it's been dogs.
Dogs, yes.
Dogs
and cats.
Dogs on leashes, and I think cats before that, yeah.
No, they still...
We're still seeing cats.
I have a cat. I think that's how the cats get in there.
But, some of them, they look like scenes you would expect to see outside at a dog park because they're on leashes they're women greeting each other and that sort of thing. But they're inside this formal... early 20th century interior.
Yeah. I always have to have a foil. In some of my earlier work, the piano was a foil. Mm. And I worked with the piano to help make a dynamic of a diagonal to break the grid up and so on. So the piano was, as I say, it was like the theme structure. And I do physically love to have animals around. I don't because of my life situation, but I feel that there's this kind of ambiance that happens between animals and people. And I'm not sure. There's a painting in the show called The Visitor. And that painting happened. There's a big dog in a very red painting. And the dog is scale-wise quite large. And I don't know how that dog happened, but I realized that was something that was compelling me. You know, I didn't decide I was going to be a kennel club painter. This dog just appeared, and there will be a time where it won't have the urgency, and then I have to drop it because you can't paint from your head. We're so intellectual anyway. You try to drop as much of that as you can. The cat is a real theme. It's been there for a long time because I live with cats, but it's partially the business of finding something to hook onto so that the formal has more levels, right? So the narrative and...
So it's not about the narrative of, say, three women sitting around a table reading a book, which is that's a theme.
No, that was a theme, and actually they were reading librettos in my head. I actually named one the libretto or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. They're looking at librettos. The books are open, but there's no clue.
It's just a book. And sometimes I did have people singing, trios and so on. For me, that is the human activity that keeps me interested,
But really, it doesn't matter what they're doing. It's more a spatial look of where they
absolutely
fit in the canvas, in the piece. Is it more of a geometric or sort of a formal design?
Well, there is a grid behind it. I mean, in my head, there's a formal grid, which I try to bust up as much as possible. The idea of having the grid there and fighting it is very exciting to me.
Now, explain that for non-artists. A grid would be, you basically...
A grid is simply a formal way of dividing the space. It's not drawn or anything like that. You don't see it. I don't have it there. But if you look at the paintings, you can see the imaginary forces of a grid behind it.
So maybe an arc form, maybe. That would be a very simple grid.
That would be a breaking of the grid, but inside of the grid.
Right.
So there are two things happening immediately. So if you put in a big diagonal, you're forcing the grid to move in a different way. So the diagonal could be an arm of somebody, or it could be a piece of furniture or a rug or the pattern. Yeah. So anything you can do to take, look, the canvas is a grid. So, you know, immediately you're fighting that. You know, it's something you're given and you work with and against simultaneously. Yeah. It's quite a ballet.
Well, and it sounds like that's where the interior process really focuses for you. It's this idea of having this grid and, as you mentioned, fighting against it.
Yeah.
Explain fighting against it that ends up in a good way on the canvas and ways it doesn't end up as a good way.
Well, because when I say fighting against it, you know, if you go with everything that is presented that seems self-evident, you're going to get wallpaper. And when you get wallpaper, you don't look at it. It doesn't mean anything. It's decorative, and there's nothing wrong with decoration, except it is not something that interacts in your life. It remains there as a softening for you, an enjoyment, a pleasure perhaps, or something to totally ignore. But you don't want wallpaper paintings or wallpaper anything that is supposed to be expressing something.
It's interesting because I'm looking at an image here where it's dogs meeting, and the woman at the center of the painting, she's being very demonstrative and throwing her arm out and her hand out very expressively, and almost a sense of grandeur as a part of it. And I was looking at that and I go, why is that arm there? Is that a question you want your viewers to think about?
Sure. I think the arm is there to activate the space, really. But it then has multiple meanings. And that's, I mean, if you have a one-liner, you know, whether it's literary, musical, or otherwise, you hear it, you see it, and you walk away and you say, oh, I get it. But this should be, I hope, a little more interesting. So that you look at it, you see it, you feel it, and then you begin to wonder, is the arm, as you say, a grand expression? But really also it breaks up the wall behind it and relates then to the arm, and they're going back and forth in tension. And tension is a word I haven't used, but that is the fight against. That's what happens. You see and feel the tension, and that's what makes a painting come alive. Where wallpaper is completely passive. And I'm not interested in passive, and I'm not interested in beauty or anything that stands by itself. I mean, if a painting is beautiful and tense, that's fine. That's ideal, you know.
My guest today is Barbara Grossman. She is the Ruth Mayo Distinguished Visiting Artist at the University of Tulsa School of Art. You can see her work, Visual Configurations, which is on display tomorrow through December 19th at the Alexander Hogue Gallery on the University of Tulsa campus. She'll also be talking about her work tomorrow at 4 o'clock, I believe, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, what also becomes readily apparent is you must love music, because there's a whole series of works on paper that look to me as though it is... having been a music student myself, it looks like it's lesson time for these women. Yeah. They're singing. They're being coached. They're being taught. Again, these beautiful backdrops, but they're the spaces of these rugs and walls, and they're singing. Tell us a little bit about that series. Has that been an ongoing theme?
I listen to a lot of music, a lot of different kinds of music. Sometimes when I work, sometimes on other times of my day or evening. I have absolutely no musical skills myself. I have always wished I could sing. I mean, I would like to be the instrument. And I think that's why one of the reasons I do these singing figures is because I imagine myself, belting out a song on key. And it's also rhythm in the painting that I hope is mimicked from the idea of music, like in the very recent oil pastel called Isfahan Rug, the Persian rug, and I think of Persian music and the kind of very often drone with the staccato on top of it and this sort of multiple sounds that are running side by side and then splitting off or coming or merging. I like that idea in the painting itself. And so music themes in the visual, I hope, connect to it. I mean, you know, a lot of it is what I like to think of, and naturally you can't control what the viewer sees.
Yeah. Talk about that from an artistic standpoint of you know, you have this, you know, internal notion of what all of that means on the paper, on the canvas. Then you'll hear reactions that are probably pretty wildly different.
Yes.
What is that like for an
artist?
Every
so often, sometimes it's fine, and you learn something about yourself. You learn something about what you've made in a way that you wouldn't have. Every so often, I feel that they're perhaps too deeply involved in pop psychology or something like that. And then I tend to dissuade that. But most of the time, you have to be pretty tolerant. I mean, after all, every single set of eyes and every single mind behind those set of eyes is different. And you really can't control that.
It's interesting because we've talked a lot about the formal process and the formal thinking
yeah.
of how you create your art. But from what I hear there, it sounds like sometimes the reactions are a little overthought.
Yes, yes. And, you know, there is a collective unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about psychology, right? But there is something in our view as human beings, whether you're looking at a Chinese Ming Dynasty vase or a Jackson Pollock or a Matisse or a Amy Silman or Susan Rothenberg, there are things that combine or come together that we as sentient beings recognize. We may not be able to express it, but I think we understand if we give it time and we just sit back and just say, okay, I'm going to spend time with this and look at it and feel it, there are things that connect for all of us, going back to the ancients, to the contemporary, and I think that's what we really can't control. That's what we can't control.
And I think there's a tendency to label that experience rather than just recognize it as this coming together moment of this art.
Yeah.
Art moment.
Yeah. Why am I interested in Indian miniatures? I mean, that's not my culture, but I feel so close to it. And it's because of the visual component in it, because I know the story of Krishna, but I don't know the religious implications and all of that. I just think we all have things that mean something to us that are outside of our daily lives. And that, we should cherish that. We're really lucky if we can find something like that, you know.
The name of the exhibit is Visual Configurations. It's on display tomorrow through December 19th at the Alexander Ho Gallery. My guest is Barbara Grossman, the Ruth Mayo Distinguished Painter. And again, this is work that harkens back to the early 20th century. I mean, the influences are from that period of time. I'm interested how you came upon, you know, this way of working. I think from the 60s, the generation of the 60s, when we had pop art, we had abstract expressionism, and yet you said, no, 1910, 1920 is at least my starting point for where I'm.
No, actually, I happen to have studied with mostly second-generation abstract expressionists, so a lot of my work was non-objective. And I think non-objective work can be as narrative-based as, you know. But I did get involved in the figure, and I think rather than dating it, 1910 or whatever, Matisse was much later, actually, is more having to do with making the figure. And I am and continue to be very enamored of de Kooning. I think he was a genius. And but, you know, he was able to fragment
And deconstruct the figure.
Yeah, that is probably the hardest thing to do because the figure is so demanding and it does not want to be broken up. And that seemed to me an enormous challenge. How can you keep the integrity of the figure but still break up the space, going back to space? And so it's not so much the era, because I'm not really interested in any particular era as I am in the paintings in themselves and how they operate. So, yes, they're representational, but if you look at early de Kooning's, of course, he was extremely, I mean, that's how he was trained.
Yeah.
So he when he came to the big breakthrough paintings of the late 40s and 50, he really understood how to maintain the figure and still push it into this contemporary space, this modernist space, which was, again, still connected to the early part of the 20th century. You see, he was definitely...
Well, and the thing is, in those 40s pictures, you can actually see that actually being torn apart, the figure being disassembled, if you will.
And that, of course, connected to the time. You know, the war was still on people's minds, the breakup of the society, the civilization in some ways. So I think I didn't start out with any particular era in mind. In fact, I still don't think about that era.
But let me stop you for a second. You were very much in the abstract expressionist school as you were starting out?
Yes, uh-huh. Yes.
And then how did the figure creep in?
Well, the figure was always interesting to me. I drew from the figure.
Mm-hmm.
And one semester, maybe it was a junior, I can't remember. We studied with one artist at Cooper Union, one artist a year for the entire year. And I wanted to try to paint the figure. And there was a woman in my class who did not like painting. And so she was perfectly willing to pose for me. She posed for me all the time. And that was what she did. And so I entered that conversation with painting that way. And I was intrigued. I was really intrigued by that notion of trying to get that figure to be activated. But I never could do the breaking up.
Mm-hmm.
De Kooning move because I'm not de Kooning, and I don't think anyone else can do it either, you know. But I think that there are people who are, I think that the whole idea of breaking up what we see, because we actually have very complicated ways of seeing. We're bifocal, so we never see one thing at a time unless we cross our eyes, you know. So that's a very interesting human phenomena.
And that's an interesting idea of going through a gallery and closing one eye and looking at it through one eye. That might be very new way of looking at things.
Yeah, or if you close one and open one and close one and open, you watch everything shift all the time. Because
mm-hmm.
everything's shifting all the time. Our eyes are moving very, very quickly to ascertain what we're looking at. So we're really quite the opposite of static. Yeah. So I don't know if I've answered your question exactly, but I didn't decide to do anything.
It
happened by just making. And I think that's how most art really happens. You just keep on making things and you kind of fall into modes of thinking and seeing and thinking and seeing and seeing and thinking, and it goes back and forth. So that period of time just happened. I mean, I love Leger. I love Soutine, but that's even earlier.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that you just go where your sensibility takes you,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And I guess I'm dating it because of that time where the interior scene, and really there might have been social comments at that particular time as well as the things that you're looking at, which is basically breaking up the space.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds to me that that's not a part of your work. You're looking at, again, just these figures, this backdrop, how you can move back and forth,
yeah.
and changing that focal plane.
And trying to make a world, a believable world,
mm-hmm.
you know, that when you're looking at it, you believe it. It's authentic to you, which is hard to do in anything, right? How do you make something? I mean, you know, we all read what resonates
mm-hmm.
as a real experience. You know, you've gone to look at something and you're just bowled over, and then you look at 10 more pictures and they're okay, but there are very few that will grab you that way. And that's true of pretty much any of the disciplines, you know. I mean, most artists pay attention to all the arts, really, and they all have that moment where they transcend the daily business of getting through the day. They you know, and that's what you're hoping will happen, but you can't make it happen. It's like you can't make someone fall in love with you. You just have to keep going until it happens. You know?
Talk about your evolution as your work, because we're looking at 10 years of the last 10 years of your work, and it's of one. I mean, you can see a continuing evolution, but it's a very subtle evolution. Can you talk about how you make it? Have you ever made a break with this sort of interior scene?
Well, actually, taking the figures outdoors, there are a couple of them. There's one that's very red called The Park. And I'm very fond of that painting right now. And that was a big break. How do you take people outdoors? You know,
the artist has been doing it for hundreds of years.
That's right. But how do I do that? You know, how do I make it work? And that was a bit of a break. You know, artists do funny things. They'll do one simple thing, and they'll think they've just moved the earth, you know, because you're so involved, excuse me, in your own pattern of working and your own ideas that just a small change is a big change. You know, it can lead to all kinds of things. So in that 10 years, you know, there was that small thing. And actually, Earl the dog was a sort of new entry, like Mamluk Carpet, I believe has a, you know, has a cat in it,
yeah,
you know, in the upper left. And the scale is a little different. The figures were a little bigger early on. Now the figures are getting a little smaller. And that's one of the things I struggle with, is the scale of things inside that world. And I'll play with how big they are and how small they are and how they press up against each other. And that, of course, is... For me, it's a big deal, but I'm not sure the viewer can see that over that 10-year span. I think when I first became a painter after school, say, I was much more representational. I actually worked from the model for a little while, and then slowly but surely weaned myself and started to invent because I couldn't afford the model. I was bored of it. The model would go away, and I'd want to paint, and I'd go, my goodness, she's not coming for another 3 days.
Well, I guess I have to figure something out.
Yeah, so I started making them up. And at first, I had this, you know, silly idea I was cheating. Well, of course I'm not cheating. I can do whatever I want, you know. So that was, of course, a huge change. But I think most artists, if you look in history, almost, I don't know how, I'm going to make this up. But, you know, I would say 95% of the artists that work representationally make it up. Most of them make it up. Very few people actually look at the motif, whether it's landscape or figures, and you know, or they combine things. The idea of invention is...
Move that tree over the other side. It looks better.
That's right. You know, change the color of that vase. You know.
Yeah.
So I can't really pinpoint that 10-year shift, but there's a shift.
And it's still subtly shifting every day.
Oh, yes, it's still changing. My goal, so to speak, is to get more and more abstract within representation. The more abstract it is, the more real it is for me.
All right, well, we look forward to that down the road. The name of the exhibit is Visual Configurations. Barbara Grossman, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Painter Barbara Grossman speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. She's the Ruth Mayo Distinguished Visiting Artist at the University of Tulsa. And you can see her artwork at the Alexander Hogue Gallery on the TU campus. Visual Configurations, featuring her paintings, oil stick drawings, and monotypes, will be on display beginning tomorrow through December 19th at the gallery. She'll also be speaking about her work tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock, also at Phillips Hall on the TU campus. If you'd like to see more of her work, it's available online at barbaragrossman1.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.